Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. Always great to catch up with you at the end of the week. For those of you who are not familiar with me, I am a retired senior special agent with the former Immigration and Naturalization Service. For those of you who want to learn a little bit more about me and my background, then I ask that you please go to my website, michaelcutler.net, where you can learn a bit about who I am and why I'm out here hitting on these issues that primarily relate to national security and a host of issues that should be of great concern to just about everybody. This evening, in fact, we have a very interesting guest planning to join us, David Meyer Levy, former history professor from the West Coast. He's now a New Yorker, otherwise engaged in business and that sort of thing. Has real experience with radical Islam, Middle East, national security-related issues. He will be joining me this evening momentarily. In fact, I believe he's on the line with us right now. David, is that you?
It is I.
Ah, wonderful. So without further ado, but let me just give my audience two websites I would love for them to go to. First of all, as I say, michaelcutler.net. The other terrific website, I'm a senior fellow with a wonderful organization known as Californians for Population Stabilization. Their awesome website is capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org. They are located, as I always like to remind people, in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California, a place that's really great to visit, especially when we get clobbered by winter weather, and I've had the privilege of being out there with them. They're great friends, great people. Doing a tough job trying to get not only Californians but everybody aware of this immigration crisis that's truly having a profound impact on virtually every town and city across America. So I ask that you check out their website and my website. And without any further ado, David Meyer Levy, I thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, I'm happy to do it. I appreciate it.
Excellent. Why don't you give my audience a little bit of a background as to who you are and what your specific concerns are? Because, you know, we're living in such wacky, turbulent times. I was just watching the coverage of Saudi Arabia for the first time refusing a seat on the Security Council. This is the first in the history of the United Nations. And I think it really the blame goes to this administration, but I'd love to get your take on that since this seems to be breaking news, as the saying goes.
Well, it is breaking news. It is quite amazing. Just the fact that Saudi Arabia should rotate into the Security Council when almost everyone familiar with the global terrorism and its threat to the West knows that it is Saudi funding which supports a very large percent of the terrorists out there. They don't work for free, and it costs a lot of money to arm them and train them and support them and then deploy them, and it is a very expensive procedure, and the Saudis are supporting it, and yet here we have a Security Council seat, which I presume happily for us they declined to accept. Probably because, this is just a guess, there's no evidence yet, but this is what it looks like. Probably because they did not want to be in a position where they could be internationally scrutinized. That would be my guess.
That's interesting, because I was just watching Fox News, and their idea was that they were upset about what's happened with Assad in Syria and the supposed removal of the weapons there, but obviously, that's just going to provide Assad with cover so that he can continue on indefinitely.
Oh, that was their take. That's certainly true. That's certainly true. One of the problems that we have is that Assad is the puppet of Iran. The
yep.
Saudis are deathly afraid of an Iranian supremacy, and especially an Iranian nuclear supremacy, because that's going to generate a nuclear arms race in the Middle East, and the Saudis don't want to see their oil reserves go up in smoke once they become radioactive. That would destroy their money.
Literally and metaphorically radioactive.
Literally and metaphorically, right. So, yeah, they have a lot of problem with Sada. And they have another problem, which, in fact, the United States faces as well, which is that the opponents to Assad in Syria, of the approximately 9, I can think of, groups that are working together as the so-called rebels against the Syrian government, 7 are al-Qaeda-related. Well, the Saudis have a lot of worry about that.
I'll have to find any white hats in that crowd.
Few white hats. And, in fact, the two more secular groups in there that seem to really want to have a democratic Syria, which become a member of, like, you know, the Western concepts of democracy and statesmanship,
yep.
They're totally outnumbered and outgunned by the other 7 pro-Al-Qaeda groups who want to turn Syria into a state from which Al-Qaeda can operate to extend its power and spread. So there's no good choices here.
No, some Arab Spring this has turned into. Boy, where is a good meteorologist when you really need one? The weather forecast is bleak. Is that a fair statement?
Bleak indeed. I would say it's frightening. The Arab Spring has been, well, presumably a disappointment to those who pin some hopes on it, but far worse than that to those who've been following it seriously. It has become the process by which vicious dictators who oppress their people but supported the USA have now been replaced by vicious dictators who annihilate their people and don't support the USA. So, you know, what have we gained here? This is absolutely mind-boggling. And
we've
the possibility... go ahead.
I was going to say, we've gone from the frying pan into the fire.
Into the fire. You know, the possibility that Al-Qaeda and its offshoots, the Muslim Brotherhood, which almost had its own state in Egypt, could in fact have a state from which to operate, enormously increases the threat, the peril, the danger of these organizations striking targets anywhere in Europe and eventually in the USA.
Well, now you're going to get to Europe, and here's an interesting segue for you to take up with us. Anas Alibi, this guy that was just brought to New York to stand trial, and I don't understand why in the world he wasn't brought to Gitmo. I don't know what in the world he's doing in New York. You know, he was the mastermind of the embassy bombings, and I'll have a little bit more about the embassy bombings in a moment, because you look at what just happened at the mall in Kenya. I mean, the world is bubbling over, and there's plenty of bad actors stirring all these pots. You've got an administration that seems disconnected, disjointed. You add to the confusion, and I don't know what to make of it, 2 high-level generals within our own military who were involved with our nuclear forces being removed for strange reasons, gambling improprieties and so forth. You know, this is a 15-ring circus. I'm not sure where we're supposed to look first. But this guy, Alibi, had been granted political asylum in England.
Yes.
And
it
so
is
you look,
amazing.
You look at England, you look at the fact that he was granted political asylum, which, by the way, even the Wall Street Journal just issued a report which blew my mind, stating that now the illegal aliens in the United States most often look for political asylum as the way to remain in the country, as a way of gaming the system. We know the terrorists have done this. The 9/11 Commission warned us about this. Great Britain seems to be no better. And meanwhile, they participate in the visa waiver program, which allows aliens, we're up to now 37 countries, to come to America without first applying for a visa. So we have peeled away a vital layer of security. You know, if an alien can't get a visa, they can't get on an airplane. If you think about Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, we've talked about him before, he couldn't have gotten on the airplane. By applying for a visa, we have a database to work with. They have to answer 40-odd questions, which can provide investigative leads. Even if they lie on some of the questions, they're going to tell the truth on others of the questions. And as an agent, that was always where you went data mining. What can I find out? Let me see if I can get my hands on the application. In fact, I did my first hearing in 97. Mary Ryan was the chief official at the State Department in charge of consular affairs. They issued the visas. And you know, if she had a phaser with her, she would have set it to obliterate, not to stun. When I said they need to hold on to those applications. Well, now they are holding on to them. But in some international airports, more than half of the people we're admitting don't have visas, so there's no applications to hold on to.
Right.
And, you know, if a terrorist lies on their application for a visa, which often happens, in fact, more than likely you arrest a terrorist not for terrorism but for lying on the visa application.
Right, exactly.
You charge them for visa fraud. That gets them out of circulation and off the street, and you can apply pressure and not let the other bad guys know, hey, we're looking at this guy not just because we don't let them know that we're looking at him because we know he's a terrorist or maybe a member of a drug organization. They just think, oh, it's an immigration arrest. Meanwhile, you know, behind that immigration agent stands a squad of either DEA or FBI agents. And I was often
right.
that INS agent who was doing just that. So we're eliminating all these methods of protection, all these layers
right.
of security.
Right.
You do a lot of flying. I do. The airports are getting more and more intrusive. I don't know why they don't combine Obamacare with the TSA at the rate we're going. All that's missing is an internal examination, and maybe in some occasions you get one. So
hopefully not.
Do you see any reason to any of this, David?
Yes, I do.
Okay,
and
what do you
really
see?
That's the really frightening part that I want to educate our listening audience into. But let's backtrack a little bit.
Okay.
The first issue is actually people who want to destroy us, infiltrating into our system, and doing it so well that they're actually invited into our system. This is beyond terrorizing. Back in May 13th of this year, the FBI announced that a gentleman named Wissam Alush, who is an Arab, he's from Egypt, had worked in the U.S. Army as a translator for several years, and then applied to work in the Defense Department. Well, half by luck and half by the fact that they did some research, the FBI Joint Terrorism Force identified him as a former fighter with the Amal militia in Lebanon.
A wing of Hezbollah.
So here we have a former Hezbollah fighter coming to the USA, legally entering the country. No one notices his background. No one notices the fact that he was not just a supporter, but a participant for Hezbollah, which is an organization in Lebanon which is committed to the destruction of the United States and Western civilization.
No
one notices
that. Client of Iran,
created by the Iranian government, by the way, back in 1983. But the main thing is, he made his way through the army, up the army's translator organization, and then
I think he was working as a contractor for the army, in fairness, but he was a translator with a security clearance.
With a security clearance. So he applied for a job with the Defense Department. Let's keep on moving up. Okay, this gentleman is a terrorist mole.
And a naturalized citizen today.
Exactly. So, and also, this is a statistic that I cannot corroborate, but I have been told that somewhere around 25% of the applicants for jobs with the CIA in translating and in research have terrorist affiliations with groups like Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and a number of other ones.
And here's something that's really amazing. You look at members of the United States Senate. Let's look at McCaskill, who railed. She was quoted in the papers over the shooting at the Navy Yard in Washington. Railed about
right.
Snowden. How did they do background checks on these people? What she doesn't understand is they did background investigations. They held security clearances. I had a top secret clearance, and every 5 years. I think it would have been easier to go to a proctologist than undergo the scrutiny, because you were called into a room, you spent time with either one or sometimes two investigators. The interview could have been an inquisition. It could run for as long as they wanted it to run, and then they have access to your bank records. They have access to everything. They have access to your neighbors, your associates. This thing takes time. They go out. They knock on doors. They interview people. It costs thousands of dollars, and even with all that, you saw where you have to wonder, how did Snowden get a clearance? How did the shooter get a clearance? How did Alush get a clearance? Well,
right.
I called up McCaskill's office, I have to tell you. I called her office. Now, in fairness to her, I try to be even-handed about this. This was at the time when the shutdown was starting to happen. But I got a young lady in her office, and I said, I'd like to speak to somebody who handles immigration. And she said, why? And I said, well, the senator has been all over this issue about background investigations. She called them background checks. Those were full field investigations. And the difference, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, between a background check and a background investigation is comparable to the difference between going to the mall and some guy has a blood pressure cuff and they check your blood pressure versus somebody who goes to a doctor and the doctor takes a chest x-ray and does an EKG and all those other great tests, draws blood. Well, guess what? Under comprehensive immigration reform that this president is pushing for like there's no tomorrow, there would be no face-to-face interview with millions of illegal aliens who snuck into the country, entered by evading the process that's supposed to keep out terrorists, spies, criminals, and people who would be harmful to the safety, national security, and well-being of Americans. And they're doing it now with the Dreamers. And what's so remarkable about the Dreamers, we're told, oh, it's about the children and everybody kind of melts like Frosty the Snowman in August. The age cutoff is 31. And if you look at the profile of the average terrorist, and I think you'll agree with me, it's somebody usually under the age of 30. So we've given
18 to 35.
Okay, we're close enough. We're there.
Statistically, that's the ballpark age, yeah.
Yeah. So basically, we have now given hundreds of thousands of aliens without a face-to-face interview. So if McCaskill is concerned about how we gave out those clearances to the shooter and to Snowden, how in the world does she support a program that would provide hundreds of thousands today of aliens lawful status, even if it's temporary, they have ID and they can go out and get driver's licenses, social security cards, and the like.
Right.
And support comprehensive reform, where we would then be talking about 20 million, 30 million. I mean, that's what happened the last time. We were told it was a million, million and a half. We wound up with almost 4 million if the same ratio holds true. And think what these 19 terrorists did to us in 9/11. So when I said this to this young lady, she said to me, I will have somebody from the immigration team get back to you. I said, wow, she has a whole team? I wanted to ask who the captain was. But needless to say, no one has ever gotten back to me. How do they have this disconnect? Are they that stupid? Are they that treasonous? I don't know what to make of it. I hate bandying the term treasonous about because, you know, that sounds kind of harsh. But if you understand national security, and if you go to the FBI website, and I wrote an article about this for CAPS, and I've written about it elsewhere, if you look at what happened during the Second World War when the Coast Guard, working with the FBI, picked up 8 Nazi saboteurs, 4 landed on Long Island, and they came here. It's like something out of an old James Bond film. They came by U-boat. They deposited them in Long Island. They deposited them in Florida. They were promptly picked up. 6 of them were found guilty, executed promptly. 2 of them wound up with lengthy jail sentences. 1 guy got 30 years. The other guy got life. And by the way, I think a couple of them were naturalized citizens also. Same deal. Come to America, learn the lay of the land, have familiarity, be able to move freely among us. And the FBI, to this day, has it on their website, and they should be proud of it. It was a great achievement. They call them infiltrators. Today,
that's exactly
them,
the term.
We call them
immigrants.
Free citizens today.
Right.
Am I crazy?
No. You're hitting it on the head, but we got to take a step back. Let me give our listeners a little bit of background, because you have mentioned correctly, and I've mentioned also, the Muslim Brotherhood.
Okay.
And the Muslim Brotherhood has been given kind of a very pleasant whitewash by our press. And what has never been discussed is the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood's openly articulated and unabashedly ballyhooed long-term goal is the destruction of American democracy and its replacement with Islamic law. Now, this is not something that I just made up or extrapolated. They say this in their own documentation. In fact, back in 2004, I think it was March 2004, the FBI entered the home of Mohammed Akram, who was a major operative of the Muslim Brotherhood living in the USA.
I'm sorry,
A-K-R-A-M. That's all right. A-K-R-A-M. Akram.
Okay.
A-K-R-A-M. So they entered his home, they searched it, they arrested him because of his associations with terrorist organizations and terrorist groups, and they found an 18-page document in his possession, which was dated 1991, at which time apparently it was created in Arabic by Muslim Brotherhood operatives in the USA. And what it says is, and I'm quoting now a section of the translation into English, "The Muslim Brotherhood operatives here must understand that their work in America is a grand jihad to eliminate and destroy Western civilization from within and sabotage its miserable house by their own hands and the hands of other believers," meaning other Muslims, "so that it is eliminated and God's religion," meaning Islam, "is made victorious over all other religions." Now, this is an 18-page directive which tells people who are participating in this directive to destroy America from within that what they must do is be in America and be nice and literally fade into the woodwork. And then when the time comes, they step forward peacefully to start influencing people in the direction that will help the Muslim Brotherhood achieve its goals.
Now, where was this reported on, by the way? Because I didn't see this anywhere.
It has gotten almost no media coverage. I have a copy on my hard drive, which I'm happy to send you. It's been discussed in a number of documents. In fact, if you Google it, if you Google Muslim Brotherhood 1991 Manifesto, I think that's the or Muhammad Akram 2004 Manifesto, you'll get it. And it is summarized in a book by Frank Gaffney, who is a well-known scholar and expert.
Frank.
You know Frank. All right. So,
sure.
And his book is called "The Muslim Brotherhood in the Obama Administration." And he has a whole list of Muslim Brotherhood operatives who have been appointed by Obama to various positions in his administration. And this book by Frank Gaffney includes a reference to the manifesto of 1991, in which the Brotherhood lays out in clear and uncertain terms its interest in being peacefully good citizens in the USA until they have the ability to influence things toward the goals of the Brotherhood. Now, when you understand that the Muslim Brotherhood is not a benevolent religious society, it's not secular by any manner of means, it's purely Islamic, it has been around for 80 years, it has millions of members throughout the Muslim world, and especially the Arab world, it then raises a question about our president, who has worked very hard since the coup in Egypt to pressure the Egyptian military and the current Egyptian government, especially the new Egyptian president, al-Sisi, to reinstate the Muslim Brotherhood. In fact, what he's done essentially is blackmail the Egyptian government by telling them that he's not going to allow hundreds of millions of dollars of aid unless they reincorporate the Muslim Brotherhood in their government. Now, the Brotherhood was kicked out during the coup because people were fed up with President Morsi and his Islamization of Egypt. And whether it was a military coup or rebellion, there's still some debate about, but essentially the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt overplayed its hand in its oppressiveness, in its arrest and torture and murder of people who were opposed to it politically or religiously, and especially secularists who spoke out about the loss of civil rights, the loss of human rights by prisoners and by political activists and by the press. So the military took over with the support of an enormous majority of Egyptians. And yet, our president, for reasons that are truly unclear, has worked very hard to reverse that. It's sort of an amazing thing. The President of the United States is blackmailing Egypt, a sovereign state, to force it to restore the Muslim Brotherhood government, which he, our president, seems to favor. Why would he favor the Muslim Brotherhood when we know that the Brotherhood's objective is the destruction of America? This is beyond comprehension. And yet...
And you're convinced that it's irrefutable that that's the goal of the Muslim Brotherhood. There's no room for interpretation, wiggle room, nothing.
There's no evidence to support the suggestion that they're only joking or that they're exaggerating. This is the stated goal of the Brotherhood from its very beginning in 1928, when Hassan al-Banna founded it. He articulated his commitment to restore the caliphate and bring Islam to its position of God foretold prominence as the supreme religion in the entire world. Now, that may be something that would be a little bit hard to achieve, but let's recall that the Nazi Third Reich talked about the Thousand-Year Reich and the Reich of Deutschland über alles, Germany
over
everybody.
Yes.
Overall, right. Well, the Muslim Brotherhood is saying the same thing about Islam, basically. So they say it in their own words, in their own publications, in their own educational things, and they've been saying it for 80 years. So unless there's some evidence to indicate that they're lying or joking, we should take it seriously.
Is there any downside to the current – I mean, I'm trying to find some silver lining to this cloud. Is there any indication that the current Egyptian government is so terrible that it would be good to get rid of them?
No, quite the opposite. The Egyptian population as a whole now has been much more peaceful, except for Muslim Brotherhood operative terrorist strikes. And it was the opposite when Morsi was in power, and the Brotherhood, as I said, like overplayed its hand with enforcing a very stringent interpretation of Islamic law, arresting, torturing, and killing opponents, attacking groups on the street who were demonstrating, and basically running a totalitarian state far more so than their predecessor, Hosni Mubarak, who was the president of Egypt for 30-some years. These guys are presidents for life. Their term is until they get assassinated by the next guy. So getting back to Obama, the problem is that we have on one hand the Brotherhood, which overplayed its hand, oppressed its own people, slaughtered its own people, and is an avowed and open enemy of the USA, replaced by the Egyptian military, which has long been, under Mubarak and under Anwar al-Sadat, a supporter of America. So one could argue that Mubarak was an oppressor and Sadat, well, actually, Sadat was pretty moderate, so I don't think you could argue he was an oppressor. But Mubarak ran a police state. Well, okay, so then you would look forward to seeing someone come to the power who would reverse that. Morsi made it worse. Then the army stepped in and took over with the support of a large part of the Egyptian population.
Correct.
So you would expect that the American president, wanting to have and Egypt, which is supportive of the USA and can serve as an ally against USA's enemies in the Middle East, which is primarily Al-Qaeda, Syria, and Iran. But instead, he's trying to undermine the military. He's blackmailing them. He's trying to pressure them into letting the Muslim Brotherhood back again. Does not make sense. That's the problem.
Does not make sense, I have to tell you. And by the way, you were mentioning before, and we got into this thing about the embassies before. There's just one other thing I want to just put out there for my listeners. You know, you look at this thing with the Dream Act and with comprehensive reform, and we're being told that these aliens who are illegal, who snuck into the country, and maybe they were brought here when they were 3 years old, maybe they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. Remember, no background investigations, no face-to-face interviews. They're undocumented. How do you prove, for example, with the Dreamers, that 15 years ago I went to this particular high school or public school or whatever? I mean, as an American, it's difficult to do that. There's no biometric. You can't give somebody your fingerprints, and it comes back, and it says, oh, yeah, that guy went to Abraham Lincoln High School. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
So unless you can go out there and compare photographs and say, do you know this guy? Do you have school records of somebody with that name to begin with? Maybe that name doesn't even show up in the school. Who knows? So without even being able to do that, how do you know who these folks are, when they got here, and so forth? Now, look at what's happened. Page 68 of the 9/11 Commission report. This is, I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission. This is astonishing. You look at the Fort Hood shooting, okay? How many times do you make the same mistake? Check this out. This is, again, from page 68 of the 9/11 Commission report. As early as December 1993, a team of al-Qaeda operatives had begun casing targets in Nairobi for future attacks. And here, of course, we're talking about the embassy. It was led by Ali Mohammed, a former Egyptian army officer who had moved to the United States in the mid-1980s, enlisted in the U.S. Army, and became an instructor at Fort Bragg. He had provided guidance and training to extremists at the Farouk Mosque in Brooklyn, including some who were subsequently convicted in the February 93 attack on the World Trade Center. The casing team also included a computer expert whose write-ups were reviewed by the al-Qaeda leaders, who I believe is this guy that they just brought to New York last week.
Alibi, yeah.
Alibi.
Right.
So we put a guy in the military back then, this is 20-something years ago, who was in fact involved with terrorism. And we weren't dealing with the onslaught of applications that we are now.
Right.
Now, think of what we go through to get on an airplane. As I said before, it's about as intrusive as going for a physical exam, and yet we're handing out identity documents to people who entered our country by sneaking in, not exactly something that gives you the warm fuzzies, and we're saying, sure, who do you want to be? I mean, could you imagine trying to get on an airplane and you hand the TSA official an index card and with a crayon you scribbled some name and said, yeah, that's me? Forget that the cards are nice and laminated and fancy and high-tech and have, holograms and glow-in-the-dark and, you know, have psychedelic colors. The bottom line is, if you don't know who they are and you don't know that the name that's on the card is really that name of that person, you may as well simply give people an index card with a crayon and say, put down the name of somebody you want to be. Why does our government get it?
Well, let's pursue the exact line that I'm giving to you guys now, because I think it leads to an answer. Now, I mentioned that our current president, for inexplicable reasons, is pressuring the Egyptian government, which is now a secular pro-American government, to accommodate the reentry, right? And basically, yeah, to change sides, to let the enemy within and let them start ruling things again. But this is actually not a new thing from our president. And this is very disturbing. He has been completely silent as Muslim Brotherhood operatives now, and more so when Morsi was in power, attack Coptic Christians, burn their churches, gang rape women, burn entire villages, kill scores of cops. Now understand, Egyptian cops are Christians, not Muslims. They lived in Egypt long before Muhammad was born. They have a 2,000-year history in Egypt. Yet, the slaughter of Christians and the destruction of their churches and other holy places, Obama is totally silent about. He hasn't said a word of criticism to them, and it's only Muslim Brotherhood operatives that are doing this. So this persecution of Christians in Egypt, which one would think would prompt anybody, certainly Christians, and certainly our president, to oppose it, passes in silence. Now, the problem gets even more complex when you recognize that Obama's literally uncritical support of the Muslim Brotherhood goes back way before the 2012 coup in July of 2012. When Secretary of State Hillary Clinton visited Egypt and met with Mohamed Morsi, she was attacked by mobs in Cairo. They threw shoes and stones and tomatoes at her car because they were protesting Obama's support for Morsi.
Right.
Now, Obama's support for Morsi antedates Morsi. As early as 2009, while the Muslim Brotherhood was still outlawed in Egypt, outlawed because from the days back in the 1970s and the late 1960s, when the Muslim Brotherhood was attempting to assassinate Egyptian officials and bring its Islamic religious extremism to the level of political and legal function in the state of Egypt, back in 2009, Obama met with outlawed Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood leaders. He invited Muslim Brotherhood leaders to attend his 2009 speech in Cairo. It was June 4th. It was his first speech to the Muslim world. And because he invited them, the Egyptian government officials who were supposed to be there did not show up. Had they been there, they would have had to have their bodyguards arrest the people whom Obama had invited. Where does this come from? It's like
it's
he
stunning.
Supports the Brotherhood. Now, this is a problem because what he's actually doing is supporting the people who want our destruction, and he's enabling, if he is successful, which so far I'm happy to say he hasn't been, enabling those same people, the Muslim Brotherhood operatives, to regain a foothold of power in a state, Egypt, which, much like Syria, could become a Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, extremist, terrorist state from which operations against anybody, Israel, other Arab states that are not aligned with them, but most important of all, Europe, could be carried out with impunity. How can Obama possibly support such a possibility?
Let me ask you a question. I'm listening to this, and it kind of leaves you with your jaw resting on the desk in front of you. So are there different factions within the Muslim Brotherhood where, you know, there's an A team and a B team kind of thing?
Well, there are factions in the Brotherhood, but none of them, not even the so-called most moderate, which Morsi is supposedly a representative of, have any problem with the underlying Muslim Brotherhood ideology, which goes back to the days of Hassan al-Banna in the 1920s. The caliphate must be restored by force. And once it is, its next job is to move against the non-Muslim countries and bring Islam to them, much the way Islam was brought to Egypt, by the sword. Islam must rule the world. Now, that's in their literature. That's been translated into numerous languages. We have it in many sources. It's not an issue of, like, interpretation or exaggeration. This is what they say. And the 1991 document simply manifests that in terms of the operation in the USA. The Brotherhood is an enemy, and there's nothing secular or moderate about any of their membership. Now, there may be some. In fact, if we have time, we'll get to the ones who are actually in the White House, who are behaving very nicely and using peaceful pressure and manipulation to advance the Brotherhood's goals, so it's not like they're cutting throats or chopping heads off, but they're still achieving the same goal.
But, you know, it's so funny because everything that I look at that's going on in our government today makes no sense if the government was representative of the American people. And I just want to get to one quick issue that's going to take us a little bit off the track, and then I want to get back to your point. But it was something that happened when I started doing some research over comprehensive immigration reform. And I don't know if you had the opportunity to read what I wrote about the impact that this would have on middle-class workers.
Oh, yeah,
computer
sure.
workers.
Of course I did. Yeah,
and in fact, CAPSWeb.org will be posting, from what they told me, my article on October 22nd. I think that's Monday if I have my calendar properly wound up and everything. And here's what most people don't know. It's like this business about, well, once we secure the Mexican border, then the sun shines and nobody needs Viagra and everyone's going to be very happy. When in point of fact, we have millions of illegals in the country who didn't just run the Mexican border. They've come in through international airports and Canada and on and on and on. I mean, this is a sieve, and they want to sort of almost a little bit plug one hole in a huge sieve and say the job is done. Everything is cool. You know, you have a mansion, and we'll paint one wall in the bathroom and declare the house to have been newly painted. It's kind of crazy. But what people don't realize is that it's more than that. This isn't just about amnesty, bad as that would be, devastating as it would be for national security. It would also allow roughly three times the number of high-tech workers with H-1B visas to come to the United States.
Right.
And for the first time, it would allow their dependents to be fully entitled to work in the United States to the point that they would be co-equal with American and lawful immigrant workers in looking for work. And these
right.
folks could do any job that they're qualified to do. They could be seamstresses. They could be school teachers. They could be engineers. They could be programmers. Doesn't matter. The idea is they get what's known as an employment authorization document. It's almost the functional equivalent of a green card for as long as it's valid. And they can pass through E-Verify. They could work anywhere. And this raises a couple of other issues, going back again to infiltration and national security.
Yes.
How many times have we seen naturalized citizens like this Hezbollah guy, Alusha, we're talking about, and others, the Times Square bomber, who either acquired lawful immigrant status or U.S. citizenship so that they
right.
could then work for companies, commit theft, you know, intellectual property theft. We've seen this with Chinese spies and so forth. So
yes.
we're giving out all these opportunities, all these visas for people to work in the high-tech industries.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the United Nations was writing about comprehensive reform, and they're holding their breath because they want it desperately, because it would mean that even more money would be siphoned out of the U.S. economy and sent to the third world. And by the way, with all the talk we hear about Mexico, the,
yeah.
the country that gets the greatest amount of money through remittances is not Mexico, but India. Last year, mm-hmm. they got about $60 billion in remittances. But the literature is very vague. It's funny how it's not as clear as it used to be, because they don't specify where it came from, that money, other than other countries. But a few years ago, before the curtain of obscurity descended, the United States was responsible for roughly half of all remittances that went to the third world. The UN
wow.
said last year over $400 billion went to the
mm-hmm.
third world. So if that 50% figure is still accurate, that means that about $200 billion was siphoned out of our economy. And I know you're a money guy, and I don't know if you're going to agree with me, so let me throw a question at you. That's why I wanted to raise
sure.
this while you're on with me.
Okay.
I remember high school and college economics back in the days when we wrote on stone tablets with a hammer and chisel.
Right.
And they said that there was a multiplier effect, that if you made a dollar, it generated five more dollars. In other words, you make a pair of shoes as a cobbler, and then you go out and you buy a TV, and the TV salesman buys some lumber so he could add an extension
right.
onto his house.
Right, right. If there's a multiplier effect in the economy, right.
Now, if you take that money and simply ship it out of the economy, you're not just losing the $200 billion, but you're losing the multiplier effect that it would have. So maybe
yeah,
we're talking about functionally losing $1 trillion overall. That's serious
Easily.
Money.
That is serious money. Now, just for clarity.
Am I wrong in what I'm saying to your thinking?
No, you're perfectly correct, but I fear that some listeners may not understand. When you say remittances, you're talking about money which people who are working here and earning an honest living
right.
send back to relatives in their home country. This
Correct.
Is not American government aid to these countries, which also totals hundreds of millions and billions of dollars.
Right. And
so
you know,
we have to add the remittances
fact,
on.
And in fact, the UN in years past at the World Bank and UNESCO and all these other terrific, wonderful organizations have said that remittances were the best form of foreign aid because the politicians couldn't screw with it. It's out of our
well,
control.
Well, it's an enormous amount of money. And on
now,
one
and,
hand, you, no, go ahead. What do you want to say?
No, and I'm going to say, and on top of all that, the added benefit to this business is that it also drives down the wages of Americans who are buying less, who maybe are now using government safety net programs. In my piece, I included a link to a Dan Rather article. And it's interesting because Dan Rather is a very liberal guy. I had the privilege of working with his son, who was an assistant district attorney years ago, on a rape case involving an Israeli national who was a real insidious character. We were glad to get this piece of work off the street out of a consideration over time. I won't get into it, but the guy was truly evil. And I worked with Dan Rather's son. And these are very liberal folks. And Dan Rather did the story called No Thanks for Everything. And it was
uh-huh.
they looked at three or four IT workers, computer programmers, who got slammed, who were replaced by Indian workers. In fact, the first person they interviewed was a woman who had an MBA in computer science, had worked for Microsoft, and graduated Phi Beta Kappa. certainly a woman with great qualifications. And she'd been there for a number of years. She had previously been a vice president of a bank on Wall Street. A bright gal. They interview her. And she comes to work one day, and they said, oh, by the way, it's been great having you here. Here's your stuff. Beat it.
Wow.
So she lost her house, lost her 401K, and lost her life savings. And she's now on food stamps. So we've taken productive Americans who were paying taxes, who were generating business. We've turned them into people in poverty who are now drawing. And that's why when I looked at Zuckerman from U.S. News and World Report, and he wrote this big report about how, you know, we have more than doubled the number of people on disability than we had when Obama first came to office. Here's the thing. And I don't like freeloaders. I don't like people who commit fraud. As an immigration agent, I was happy to put handcuffs on people who defrauded the government. But you also have people who for 20 and 25 and 30 years worked diligently, got up every morning, went to work, trudged off at O'Dock 30, stood on an ice-cold subway platform or train platform or slugged it out in traffic or wherever they got to work and did their jobs. And suddenly not only lose their jobs but can't get a replacement job. Now,
right.
If you're given the choice of going on disability if you can, or becoming homeless and maybe losing your children to child welfare, what in the world are you supposed to do?
Well, you've raised a question that I'm not in a position to answer.
But
you are hitting
the point
upon, absolutely, that the issue is really problematic, that there's a limit to the degree to which we as a country can create an economy robust enough to keep ourselves employed and support innumerable countries outside of our country that desperately need help but become part of our payroll.
Well, and you
and
can't give charity when your own children are going to bed without food at night.
Precisely. But to bring things back to our topic,
sure.
You shouldn't
give charity.
But
this weakens us,
charity.
By the way, and I worry that it's almost as though an effort to weaken us, because even if you go to the Art of War, if you empty out your treasury, how do you pay for your military? In effect, the military now says they can't even fight a single war. That was a new analysis as of 2 days
yes,
ago.
Yes, that was a new article that came out that the military is losing its capacity to defend the country because of the cutbacks. That really is a whole different conversation. But what I want to point out and kind of bring it back to our topic
is that I just wanted to get into a broader issue, but yes.
Sure, okay. But we as a country should not be supporting the countries whose leadership is committed to our destruction.
You would think
that
that's
doesn't
common
make any
sense.
Sense.
You
that
would
think be
that's
like common
sense.
Sense. And yet, that's what we're looking at. That's what we're. So let me. We're getting out of time, and I wanted to get back to the real issue.
Sure, go ahead.
That's
by
the
way, for those of you that are calling
all.
In, I just want to make one quick point. I know there are people calling in. Please bear with us. I don't want to get to your calls right now because I do want to hear what David has to say. But I'm going to go long. I don't know what your schedule looks like, but I'm willing to go long. So I will go beyond 8 o'clock. So
okay.
Those of you
so
listening.
What I want to point out is we talked about Alush who got caught and about the 25% of the terrorists who tried to infiltrate the CIA, and they got caught. There's a whole bunch who didn't get caught, all right?
Yes.
And I'll give you just a couple of examples. The numbers are much greater than that. But there's a very talented gentleman named Rashad Hussein, who was for a long time in his earlier youth and young adulthood, a worker with the Muslim Brotherhood front organizations, including the American Muslim Council and the International Institute of Islamic Thought, both of which are American institutions supposedly to educate about Islam. But these are institutions that are fronts, which the State Department acknowledges. I'm not making this up. The State Department acknowledges they're fronts for al-Qaeda. Yet, in January of 2009, Hussein was named Deputy Associate White House Counsel. Why does the president appoint to the White House counsel a gentleman who has been involved for years with al-Qaeda and other terrorist organization front groups working in the USA?
I'm going to play devil's advocate. How do you know that he is?
Oh, how do we know that he is
his
own history is very hidden and denied it. I mean, it's on his, like his CV that he belonged to, worked for these organizations. The problem is that later, back in the 1990s, when the Holy Land Foundation trial took place, the Holy Land Foundation evidence that was brought forward during the trial, in which the Holy Land Foundation was eventually found guilty and dismantled, and a number of its board members put in jail, the evidence that was brought forward in the trial included the names of numerous Muslim organizations in the USA which were supposedly educational or for the common weal or to help Muslim immigrants or to help Muslims in poverty elsewhere in the world, legitimate 501c3 organizations, yet with board members and supporters and money from Al-Qaeda. And the State Department validated this, and the trial validated. That's why we have a whole host of what are called unindicted co-conspirators.
Correct.
Yes.
All right, now I got to ask you another. Now, you're raising a bunch of questions, and I have to ask you a question. I don't know if you have an answer. So,
well, go ahead.
We don't rehearse these programs in advance, folks. That makes the conversation interesting. Cause I don't want to do an interview. I want to have a conversation with my guests, and that's what I'm trying to do this
evening. That's what we're doing, sure.
And I think it's a good way to do it. If you look at what happened right after 9/11, the Bush administration allowed members of Bin Laden's family to flee the United States. All other airplanes were grounded, but they were airborne.
Yes, there was that one airplane that had like 240 of his friends and family. Yes, I remember
How
that.
Do you account for that? Am I crazy?
No, but for the sake of time, because we are approaching 8 o'clock, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. All right.
Good.
Maybe at another time I'll go through a whole bunch, literally a dozen people like the gentleman that I just mentioned, Rashad Hussein, who have been appointed to positions of power and influence in Obama's government. The list is too long. We can't go through all of them. So I'll just jump to the one who is the most frightening of all, which is a very attractive and high-profile young lady named Huma Abedin. You may be familiar with her because she is the wife of a gentleman.
Weenie.
Yes, that's right. So she is standing by her man.
What was his name again? Something Danger?
Oh, right. Captain Danger or something of that sort. That was his online
name. Actually, I think Hispanic name that he acquired somehow. But yes.
Okay. But
Captain
anyway,
Midnight Baby. I mean, this guy's weirder and weirder
truly
and weirder.
Weird. He's Jewish. She's Muslim. Now, in Muslim tradition, a Muslim woman cannot marry a non-Muslim man. So this raises a question in general about why in the world they did, but that's not our issue. The main thing is that Huma Abedin has been for decades a close confidant, good friend, and advisor,
Hillary.
A counselor for
Hillary
Clinton.
Right.
Right. Now she's in a position, thanks to her work with Hillary, of advising the woman who was once our Secretary of State and who could be our president.
But to borrow a phrase, what difference does it make?
Well, yeah, right.
To quote Hillary out of context.
Okay. The problem is that Huma Abedin has very close relations with people who were leaders in the Muslim Brotherhood and a financier of Al-Qaeda. Now, let's go back. Both of her parents were active in the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Her father passed away a number of years ago, but he worked for the Brotherhood in Egypt, and he ran – actually, he moved to Arabia at a certain point where he ran the Journal of Muslim Minority Affairs, which was supported by the Saudis and which promulgated not just virulent anti-Semitism, but also Muslim global supremacism. Now, those two things don't fit very well with someone who's growing up in that environment and is now the consultant, the confidant, and the close friend of perhaps the future president. But it gets even worse because she and her father worked very closely with a number of major leaders in Saudi Arabia who were among the top leaders of Al-Qaeda. Don't forget, Al-Qaeda was funded by the Saudis for many, many years until Al-Qaeda leadership turned against and began to condemn the Saudi royal family because it wasn't orthodox enough. So going back into the 80s and 90s, her connection with Al-Qaeda is very, very strong. She even was had very close ties with Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who was the leader of what was called the Union for Good, which is a Muslim Brotherhood organization which attempts to enforce Sharia law on, well, basically anybody that they can. So it's uncomprehendable that she would be in a position, as she is now, as a close confidant to people close to the White House, to influence the thinking of our president, of our future president, of our former Secretary of State, to the point where they may make decisions based upon what she has suggested that are completely contrary to American national security interests, but are supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Now, let me ask you a question. Let's be cynical and skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are people listening this evening saying, oh, talk is cheap. If people wanted to verify for themselves her linkage, where is the smoking gun?
Well, probably the best place to go is a review, is an article which was done in the National Review. And it can be, you can get it online, National Review online, www.nationalreview.com. It's called The Houma Unmentionables. Author is Andrew McCarthy. So his article is very detailed, and his hypertexts take you to original documents, and he documents exactly what I've been summarizing for you. And if we had more time, we could go into more detail about that. But the bottom line is that there is not any way that you could argue that she has not been active in Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda related organizations. So maybe you could say, if you want to play, as you said, devil's advocate, you could say, okay, so she has been involved, but, you know, that was some years ago, and now she's kind of like, you know, a more mature person. But
she's reformed.
Never,
she's seen the light.
Yeah, well, she has never made any statements to suggest that she no longer supports the goals that her organizations were, you know, had. Nor has she ever made any statements condemning the activities of Al-Qaeda and the Brotherhood and Hezbollah and Islamic Jihad and dozens of other Muslim terrorist groups that perpetrate terror acts around the world. And Al-Qaeda certainly is clearly behind the attacks in the USA. Obviously, September 11th, but also the recent Boston bomber attack.
Yep.
We know that the two brothers, who were trained by Al-Qaeda. So to have her as in a position of power, one has to ask the question that you raised a little while ago, which is basically, where's the background check?
And you see, by being an advisor, they don't have to have confirmation hearings. They just sit there and whisper in the ear of the person that they're working with.
Precisely. So therefore, our president has said, I want this type of person to whisper in my ear. Now, why in the world has he done that? And she's the top of the iceberg. There's dozens of others that we don't have time to get into now, like the Rashad Hussein that I just mentioned a few minutes ago, who are in positions of power and influence throughout the Obama administration. And these are people who would never pass a background check if there were one done on them. How can he, in good conscience, as the commander-in-chief of our army, and as the single most powerful person, leader in the world, have that enormous gap in the security of his own a group of advisors?
By the way, to those of you joining me, this is David Meyer Levy, who's with us. He's an expert on Middle Eastern terror groups, former history professor from the West Coast, and now a transplanted New Yorker. Is that a fair description?
Transplanted New Yorker. That's a good way to put it, yes.
and good friend. But I'm looking at all of this, and it's kind of nuts. It's kind of like you want to say, whose side are our leaders on?
Well, that really brings us to what I'm going to suggest, not as an answer, but as an impression.
Okay.
When I look at all this, and what I've given you and your audience now is just a very, very small piece of it. My file is many inches thick, and there's books written about it, like Mr. Gaffney's book. When you look at the evidence and you see how the type of people who with whom our president has surrounded himself, and you look at his preference for the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and you look at the silence about what the Muslim Brotherhood has done to Christians in Egypt and to its political opponents, Christian and Muslim, and the opposite, the condemnation of far less vitriolic and far less problematic behavior by the current Egyptian government, what one, I think, would be inclined to conclude is that he favors the Muslim Brotherhood. He wants them to win. Now, that can't work if he wants the USA to be freed from the threat that the Brotherhood creates. It's, in fact, the opposite. If the Muslim Brotherhood, God forbid, wins in Egypt, then Egypt becomes the launching pad for jihad against any nonconformist Muslim countries, like, for example, Tunisia or Morocco, any local enemies like Israel. And then once those are handled and their consolidated power goes from the North Africa to Iraq, then they can turn on
Europe
the rest.
And the United States.
Absolutely.
And again, if you look at, and let's go back again to this guy al-Libi who gets political asylum in Great Britain. How many more al-Libis are running around freely in Great Britain right now? Or Germany? I mean, remember the Hamburg mosque from which the 9/11 terrorists planned and ultimately launched their attack on America.
Well, we haven't got time to get into this, but I will point out, as just as kind of a touching upon it, the infiltration in Europe is far more thorough than it is here.
Well,
the infiltration of Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, a group hardly known and never discussed by our media called Hizb ut-Tahrir, which means the Party of Freedom.
How do you spell that?
H-I-Z-B, hyphen A-L, hyphen T-A-H-R-I-R, Hizb ut-Tahrir.
Okay.
So this group, which numbers maybe at most 5,000 active terrorists, has declared that their goal is to create the new caliphate. And as far as they're concerned, the caliphate begins with them. Their chief area of operation is the Gaza Strip. They're actually competitors with Hamas for rule in the Gaza Strip, but they are so popular among the majority of Muslims in the Gaza Strip that Hamas is very reluctant to take action against them. Well, Hizb ut-Tahrir...
How do you account for that?
Because the idea of Muslim supremacy is attractive to many Muslims. I mean, how do we account for a Nazi popularity of Hitler?
I was just going to say, it sounds like what happened after the Weimar regime in Germany with the Nazis.
Exactly. You know, the German people, for a variety of reasons, the majority of them, wanted their place in the sun, just the way the Kaiser had promised them before World War I. And supporting the man who promised them that place in the sun made sense. So the organization, Hizb ut-Tahrir, which promises that it's going to work toward creating the caliphate again. Don't forget, in Islamic tradition and history and religion, the caliph, khalifa, is the substitute for Muhammad. That's what the word khalifa means. It's the exchange, the substitute. So he's a substitute for Muhammad. He is the leader who has direct hotline to God. It is a religious imperialism which threatens the West. And Hizb ut-Tahrir had a conference in Boston in 2003. It drew hundreds and hundreds of people about how to implement this in the USA. Nobody was arrested. Nobody had any problem with it. As subversive as it is and as threatening as it is, you know, free speech. They have the right to say those things, and they do. And that's one of the beauties of our society and political organization. At the same time, it makes us very vulnerable. And we have someone at the helm who seems to have a penchant for exactly those same goals, we are in deep trouble. That's my suggestion. I hate to say it, and I hope I'm wrong.
I hope you're wrong, too. I mean, this is so disturbing. But as I say, you know, when you look at all of the actions our government is taking across a broad panoply of issues.
Yes.
You know, it's not just one problem. As I said when I was on with Megyn Kelly, there's a lot of holes in our boat. Of course, there I was referring to the immigration system. But we can look at the government in general and ask yourself, what is it that this government is doing that's in the best interests of the average American? And you'd be hard-pressed to come up with anything, I believe.
Well, see, that's an area that I don't feel qualified to go into because American politics... You know, the peril, the existential threat that we face is on one level.
Because what we're doing is destroying the middle class, destroying incentives for kids to go to college. Student loans look more like mortgage payments than loans. And now they are of questionable value, and even when you acquire that education, of getting a job. I mean, look at this thing that Dan Rather reports did. And what's so remarkable is Dan Rather is quite liberal. And the last guy that he interviewed, and that's why I really suggest that you folks out there either go to my website and you'll be able to read the article, or you can reach out to me, by the way, through michaelcutler.net, or wait till October 22nd, which I think is Monday. It'll be up on the CAPS website. But if you watch that Dan Rather documentary, it's 1 hour. It's really, really well done. And at the very end, he interviews this guy who had worked in IT for Blue Cross Blue Shield in Florida. And the guy is so angry and so distraught. He said, you know, I worked as a volunteer to get Obama elected, and he has betrayed us. Now, for Dan Rather to include that, I mean, this wasn't a live broadcast. This was edited. It was very polished, very professionally done, as you would expect the former anchor of CBS Evening News. It was as professional as what he did when he was with CBS. This was HDNet Productions.
Right.
To include that statement almost knocked me out of my chair, to be very blunt about it.
Well, again, I don't want to comment on American politics. It's not an area where I have credentials. But
I think there are many people. But you know the point I'm making.
Yeah, the broader question that you raise is the threats to the American way of life, basically, which are being generated by our current administration. What I have the capacity, you know, intellectually in terms of my education and experience and background, to focus on are the specific military and paramilitary threats that are being enabled, enhanced, exacerbated by current Obama policy. Yes. That creates the greater problem for me, because if we turn things around in a future election, we can rebuild the economy. If, however, our government falls to an Islamic jihadist, extremist, pathological terrorist attack, and we find ourselves facing internal terrorism and external invasion, we may end up with no America.
Yeah, that is very, very disturbing.
Yes. I mean, and I'm sorry to say, most people do not realize that the threat is an existential one. They want us either dead or Muslim. And they say that, and there's no hesitation on their part. And by they, let me point out, I mean people in the Muslim world, Arabs and otherwise, who are committed to jihad, to making Islam supreme. The people who are not, they're just good old-fashioned people, and they want to, you know, raise crops and a family and live a decent life and get their kids off to a good start. No problem with them. That's totally out of the picture. But these guys,
the true believers,
I don't even want to say true believers.
The true believer of this violent jihad where we're the enemy is what I mean by that. I don't mean true believer of the religion.
Right.
You're right.
Right.
And we have to be careful about the language.
Absolutely. Well, that's what I was getting at. We have to be careful with the language. Nothing against the true believer who wants to come to this country and get a job and enjoy the American dream and raise his kids and contribute to our society. That's great. That's my grandfather.
Muhammad Ali is a Muslim, and I would hardly consider Muhammad Ali to be anything but a gentleman and a wonderful human being who's unfortunately hobbled with Parkinson's. I actually met him when he was the champ, and I never met a more gracious human being in my life, I have to tell you. I don't see Islam that way as a threat, but the way it has been perverted by this bunch is a whole other story.
That's exactly the issue. Unfortunately, and this is where part of our problem really comes from, that perversion has support among a certainly large, I don't know how large, but certainly large and growing population of Muslims throughout the Arab and the non-Arab Muslim world. And this is frightening because it takes a coup in Egypt to replace the Brotherhood overplaying of their hand and becoming violent and oppressive. And then we want them back again? The people who are the Egyptian populace as a whole seems a lot happier with the army in charge. Why are we interfering? And the people who want the Muslim Brotherhood back because they, as individual Muslims, believe that the jihad is the way to advance Islam and to fulfill Allah's will, we're never going to win their hearts and minds. It's part of their religious belief that's been around for 1,400 years. So why aren't we working with those who, in fact, contend that Islam belongs in the modern world like other religions, and jihad is not the way to do that? That's the people that we should be working with and supporting, but we're not.
Fast, quick question. It would seem that Russia will probably fill the vacuum in Egypt in terms of military and funding and so forth.
Yes.
How do they look at all this? Do you know? Do you have a way of knowing that?
Putin is delighted. Putin is delighted. If you read English translations of Moscow newspapers, he's thrilled. He's won several coups. He's pulled the wool over Obama's eyes on a number of situations, and this is no different. Egypt has always been, for centuries, the leading Muslim intellectual and religious scholarship center of the Muslim world. So it's very influential. It's very powerful. When Anwar Sadat expelled the Russians, it opened up a door. This was in the 1980s. Opened up a door for American politics to reestablish American influence in the Middle East. But
right. We
dropped the ball. We didn't do it. And instead, we just literally did the opposite. And it's ironic because part of the anti-Israel propaganda is that America loses face in the Arab world because it supports Israel. America's lost face in the Arab world because it supports the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. But, again, I don't want to get into that in detail because it's a complicated issue and, we've kind of run out of time. So
it's like when you go on TV and they tell you, we've got 3 minutes, tell us everything you know. And I've been in that situation too many times.
Yeah. Yes. So do you want to take some callers if there are any still hanging around?
Sure. Let me do that. Let me start out with hello. You're on the Michael Cutler Hour. Who's this? Hello.
Sounds like
Steve. My friend Steve Salvi is here. Let's see what Steve has. Steve, is that you? Hello, Steve.
Can't hear anybody.
I don't hear crickets. Steve Salvi. Okay, I guess not. So that solves that problem. But anyway, I guess they're just listening. Look, I think the perspective that you have provided is a wonderful perspective. It's something that's going to cause me to go and do some research. You're always thought-provoking, which I think is a good thing, and that's what this is supposed to be about. You know, one of the saddest things, and it was interesting, I was listening to the doctor speaking, who's become a contributor to Fox News, and he said that, you know, they've divided us up, and it's horrible. You know, by age, by gender, by race, by religion, by party affiliation. At the end of the day, we're all Americans. And that's the point that I've always liked to make. The First Amendment is about the right for freedom of speech and the right to peaceably assemble so that you can have the debates and the arguments.
What's
unfortunate is the media seems missing in action. The journalists, most of the news programs, to use a Yiddish term, are dreck. You watch these programs, and they're fascinated with some woman who found a way to make cake without flour, and that takes on as much significance as the story of the Saudis not wanting to sit on the Security Council at the UN. It becomes absurd. It's a three-minute food fight between two talking heads. You walk away from the TV with a headache rather than with information.
Right.
And that's why I have this program, because, you know, after 9/11, I said, you know something? Somebody needs to stand up and provide the information that, for one reason or another, and that's a story for another day, the media
right.
refuses to cover. The fact that we're not taught to ask questions. You know, you were a teacher. And I've often said to people, in fact, I had this conversation with a professor that I was speaking with last week. I said, you know, we've learned how to answer questions. That's what exams are. We've been taking tests since first grade. Why in
right.
the world do we not teach people how to ask questions as well as answer them? And he was dumbfounded. I said, maybe being Jews, where you know we answer questions with the questions, so maybe we were predisposed that way. But all kidding aside, people will take what they're told without thinking. You look at global warming, and I was speaking to a professor who's into science, and I said, how many variables are there that go into climate? And he said, many. I said, do we know them all? He said, no. I said, then how do you know that carbon dioxide is the culprit? And he was dumbfounded. I mean, but that's the issue. If you don't even know what all the variables are, then how can you provide a remedy without knowing what the cause is? Now, I'm not saying that carbon dioxide might not contribute, but we know the sun's a variable star, which means it changes its energy output. We know that, by the way, water vapor is a greenhouse gas. So if we got rid of carbon dioxide and we're running around the cars with fuel cells pumping out steam, that could have the same impact on the environment.
Right. Yeah.
And no one asks
these
questions. And shouldn't we be asking those questions?
Yes, somebody should be asking those and many other questions as well. The fact that they are not is a condemnation of the intellectual leadership of our society.
Yeah.
That's really
I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
This is how sheep operate. You lead them by the nose, you tell them this is the way it is, and you go, okay. It's like when you were a kid and you said, I want ice cream, and your mother said no. And you said, but please, can I have ice cream? And she said no. And then finally you said, why not? And then she said, because. And you shrugged your shoulders and went to your room.
Right.
And now we're being told by the media and this administration that, to be fair about it, other administrations, because.
Yes.
And because is not an answer.
No,
what do you
that's
think
right.
of that?
Well, that's what I mean by the failure of intellectual leadership. And the media is complicit in that. We could do a program on the media sometime if you want.
I would really
the media
love
is
to
complicit.
That.
Good. All right.
You
so
can put
we
on your other hat
point.
As an educator. You wear so many
right,
hats.
Exactly.
Do you have a haberdashery shop? Or
No, just one hat.
Okay.
Try not to get involved in other things. All right. But
I have to tell you, it's wonderful having you on the program. It's always great sitting down and chatting with you. You're always thought-provoking. It doesn't always help me get enough sleep. They keep talking about how important sleep is, and then a conversation with you, and there goes my sleep for this evening. You know,
well, we shouldn't have this conversation at 9 p.m., you know.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
But you know, it's serious enough that this could keep me awake if we have the conversation at 9 a.m., because it will take days to, you
it's
know,
like
I said to Jim Sensenbrenner when he was chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, I said, Mr. Chairman, if I can't sleep at night, I sure as hell don't want you to be able to sleep at night either.
That's right. That's right.
Misery wants company.
Right.
But these are very thought-provoking issues. And folks, I'm thrilled that you're with me on these programs, that you tune in on Friday evenings, or if you're listening as a podcast, when you get to it, that's fine, too. That's one of the great things about my program, is you can listen to it after the fact. But if it motivates you, I want you to do digging. I want you to confirm what you hear, and I want you to go out there and make your elected representatives accountable. Make them represent you. And it's not going to happen by sitting on your rear end and watching TV. Write those letters, make the phone calls, arrange to meet with your elected representative, or at the very least with his staffers, and let them know that you're paying attention. Because by not getting involved, by throwing up your hands and saying, this is too big for me to grapple with, simply encourages the characters that are out there to ignore we the people. And that's something that we have to change before we hit the point of no return. And I know we're on the precipice. I will tell you that all of these things that are going on simultaneously give me at least great cause for pause. I don't want to be the gloom and doom guy. I think that we're a resilient country with very creative and devoted people. But if we don't
start acting
like Americans, we will pay a price for this, and our children
may pay a price. Children and grandchildren. What you said just now is very important. It kind of like reinforces what I said before. The many problems that we're facing, we have the capacity to deal with if we rearrange our leadership and refocus on these things. But if we don't deal with the terrorist problem, we may indeed never be able to deal with the other ones. That's why, for me, the terrorist problem is the most important one.
Yeah, well, you have to be breathing in order to take care of the other issues.
Right.
it's
can be
difficult when you stop
also.
Breathing to do anything meaningful.
Right.
Then you wind up like Beethoven decomposing. But anyway.
That's an old joke.
It's a very old joke. It shows you how old I am.
I wasn't going to say anything.
But seriously, having David join us this evening has really been eye-opening, thought-provoking, question-raising, and we need to ask these questions, folks. We really need to look at the larger picture. We have to ask our leaders if they are the captain of the ship or the captain of the airplane or whatever it is, we're driving
whatever
the bus,
is, right.
What the destination is. When we are encouraging more and more foreign workers to replace American workers on the job and America does nothing about it, you need to ask why. When we are educating more and more foreign students, and by the way, here's something else. America has been very strong on preventing the proliferation of nuclear weapons, but then we teach foreign nationals in our schools the high-tech sciences that enable them down the road to become involved in either nuclear physics or biology or whatever, what does that do to world security and peace? What does it do to America's security? So we really need to understand that this immigration issue, which is the one that I always focused on, isn't a single issue, but as I always like to point out in my commentaries, a singular issue. Because understand that the purpose of our military is to keep our enemies as far from our shores as possible. When we don't secure the borders and enforce the immigration laws effectively from within, then we are undermining the work and the gallantry and the incredible sacrifices of the men and women in the armed services because we are allowing the enemies to be with us inside our country. That's not acceptable. That's not to besmirch decent people who come here. That's not to say that anybody who runs the border is a terrorist and wants to cut our throats and rape the women. But what I am saying is that there is a procedure in place that's designed to keep the bad guys out. It's comparable to the homeowner who looks through the peephole before admitting a stranger into his home. You know, knock-knock jokes, and I'm not going to tell any bad ones tonight. I'm sparing you,
good.
David, and everybody. But they're universally accepted. Because around the world, if you live in a house that has a door, then you know the knock-knock jokes because it's the accepted way of asking permission to enter into somebody else's property. And that's what immigration is supposed to be about, to make certain that we don't let people in who, at the end of the day, will contribute to our undoing. It is reasonable. It is proper. It is not anti-American. It is foolish in the extreme to think otherwise. And yet we have members of Congress and local governments with their amnesty, with their sanctuary policies, who are undermining our safety, undermining national security, undermining the American dream, because they're looking either for political campaign contributions or political leverage. Certainly not in the best interest of America or Americans, and they need to be made accountable. That's why I always like to say that democracy is not a spectator sport. Your thought as we get close to the bottom of the hour.
As we conclude, right. Well, I was just going to say, what you just said now is kind of there's another dimension to it, which is that when you take a political stand or advance political decisions or legal decisions, that undermine our security in whatever venue you're talking about, whether it's immigration or an economy or whatever, what you're actually doing is advancing the Brotherhood's manifesto that I made reference to earlier. You're making it easier for them to get in, to infiltrate, to reach positions of power, and then ultimately to undermine our whole society. That's why this is treason. It threatens the well-being of the entire country.
Absolutely remarkable. I was in front of a room filled with the military brass, mostly generals and colonels, and I always tell people, you know, if you get up in front of a room of people and give a presentation, don't be accused of being an unlicensed anesthesiologist. Keep it interesting. And so I decided to wake them up. They were a little lethargic. They had a really wonderful lunch. This was over at the Capitol Hill Club. And I said, why in the world do we have a military? Now imagine that statement in front of that audience. They all turned into Jack Nicholson lookalikes and the Few Good Men. And I thought they were going to want to rip my head off. But when I made the point that their mission is to keep our enemies as far from our shores as possible, the light bulb went on, and one general came up to me and said, I feel embarrassed that I'd never thought of immigration from those terms. You see,
yes.
The other side has been very good at making the sound as though you're unreasonable if you say to somebody, hey, listen, if you're going to come into the United States, there's a way to do it, and the way has to be followed, and if you violate that way, then we're going to seek to remove you. There is nothing inappropriate. When someone, God forbid, breaks into someone's home, you don't then say, oh, I guess I'll have to prepare the guest room for this guy and find out what he'd like for breakfast. This is trespass. This is breaking and entering. And normally it's dealt with effectively, not by saying, well, now that you're here, would you like to bring your family? I mean, it's so incomprehensible, not only to me, but to my former colleagues at the old INS and to the people who still work for ICE. And if you look at what the union officials at ICE and at Citizenship and Immigration Services have had to say, they, too, are very upset about this whole deal. I think I just lost David, so I'm going to kind of wrap things up, folks. It's been wonderful it's been wonderful having David on, and it's always wonderful joining you. I know last week we had a technical difficulty, and so the program did not air for those of you that were listening and wondered what happened. Every once in a while, computers go haywire. But it's always great joining you at the end of the week right here on the Michael Cutler Hour. Again, I'm going to remind you about two websites I would very much like for you to go to, and that's michaelcutler.net. And please visit capsweb.org. My friends out in Santa Barbara would very much like for you to visit their website. They work hard at providing the information that's not being provided by the mainstream media. And that's really a problem. Because if you think about it, the only way that we really know what's going on is by what journalists and others who are in the position of knowledge tell us. Most of what we know, we learn from other people. Few of us ever get to witness newsworthy events, as the saying goes, live and in person. And that's why this is so important. So I wish you all a very good weekend. And remember, please, folks, democracy is not a spectator sport. I ask that you contact your elected representatives and let them know what your concerns are, because seriously, folks, that's the only way that we're going to make our government truly represent us. Have a great weekend, everybody. Look forward to joining you again next week, same time. Until then, good night.